From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air.
Hey.
I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our week of great music with Andre Benjamin, who goes by the stage name Andre 3000. He's half of the hip-hop duo Outkast. Benjamin is also an actor. His most recent film is Idlewild. Then, Iggy Pop talks about the wild stage antics and music that made him the godfather of punk.
I've been around the world, seen so many pretty girls, but I still get overwhelmed when I look in your eyes. Been from Maine to Spain, but everything seems the same. I only feel a change when I look in your eyes. I know you're upper class. I know you've got pizzazz.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're continuing our week visiting with great singers who write great songs. Today we're featuring Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000. He's half of the duo Outkast, recently described in the New York Times as the biggest-selling and most critically adored hip-hop act of the last decade. Their 2003 double album, Speaker Box The Love Below, which included the hit Hey Ya, sold 11 million copies and won 3 Grammys. Andre's partner in Outkast, Antoine Patton, a.k.a. Big Boy, is a rapper. Andre sings as well as raps and draws on funk, pop, punk, and jazz. There's an exuberance and sense of fun in a lot of his music, and even in the way he dresses, which ranges from elegant to outrageous. In 2004, Esquire named him the world's best-dressed man. A few years ago, Andre crossed over to acting. Most recently, along with Big Boy, he made the film Idlewild, which is now out on DVD. Terry spoke with Andre earlier this year. Here's one of the songs from the movie.
That's Andre Benjamin from the film Idlewild. Is this the kind of song that you would have written yourself if it wasn't for this movie?
Yes and no. Believe it or not, that song is about 6 years old.
Really?
And yeah, originally it was a guitar-based song, and it was kind of just me and the beat playing a guitar. And I had some of the lyrics even 5 years ago, and when we were doing this movie, I thought it worked perfectly. And so I had to change the production a little bit and make it more piano-based because electric guitars, I mean, they were invented back then, but they weren't really where they are now. And I added a second and third verse, and Big Boy, you know, came on and put his thing on and make it what it is now. So, yes, I mean, even the lyric, you know, ain't nobody like my style. You know, I like my fire. They blow it out. You know, that was something that Andre 3000 was actually feeling, you know, 5 years ago before the movie came about. So it just so happened that when the movie came around, Percival was going through the same thing that Andre 3000 was going through. So it made total sense. And just the singing style was different because the way I sang it before, it wouldn't work for 1930. So, you know, by listening to a lot of Cab Calloway things, you know, it was like big voice, big throat, like huge production, horns, you know. And so I just made it into what it is now.
I love the way you talk about Andre 3000 as if he were a person that you knew, you know?
Well, I know him sometimes, you know.
He's your persona for the band Outkast. So how do you see Andre 3000 as compared to yourself, Andre Benjamin?
I guess if you can imagine, like if you're a kid and you're in the mirror and you're playing dress up and you're this other character, and as soon as your mom walks in, you change back into that person. And so Andre Benjamin was the kid that sat there and said, hey, what can I play? And he's in the mirror and he's putting on his cowboy and Indian suit. Once he puts on his outfits or once he starts to play and get into his kind of fun head, he's Andre 3000. You know, so Andre 3000 is that character within Outkast that kind of just goes there and has a ball, you know, does his thing. Andre Benjamin is, you know, the person that goes to Whole Foods, you know, that goes to the mall, you know, goes to the dry cleaners, you know, pumps gas, you know. That's my mama name. My mama gave me that name, Andre Lauren Benjamin.
One of the things that you you have to learn as an actor is how to project vulnerability, because there are roles you're going to play in which you're vulnerable, and that's certainly the case in some scenes in Idlewild, for example. And vulnerability is in some ways exactly the kind of thing that a lot of rappers try to not express. Rappers on the whole, I mean, I think a lot of rappers try to maintain a very tough and hardened persona.
Right.
So I'm wondering, was there a transition for you of exposing more vulnerability both in your music and in your acting?
Yeah. I think, I mean, not just in rap, I mean, in life, period. I mean, when I started off, I mean, we were just, you know, straight street rappers, you know, and I do understand where it comes from. I mean, a lot of actors have a lot of music guys or rappers have a hard time, you know, getting rid of this character that they've built up, you know, their whole career. And I don't think it's a thing of, you know, them pretending or trying to be hard to put on. But it's like the street life, it won't allow you to show, you know, that soft side because, I mean, you'll get trampled, you know, just in the street. And so you have to kind of toughen up or man up in a certain kind of way. And if you built your whole career on letting people know, you know, that I don't play, and you have to get into a character that does play or that does let other emotions come out, I mean, that may be a hard step, but even before I started doing film, I mean, in life, I mean, I knew I had to take my music other places because once again, I got bored with doing the same thing, so I got deeper and deeper into my music, and when I got deeper and deeper into my music, I mean, I had to expose certain sides of myself, and even when you look at Speaker Box and the Love Below was just that. That was the meaning of the Love Below. I mean, like on the top of a man, I mean, you have this kind of hard shell or this kind of, you know, I'm tough and nothing can hurt me. But the love below is those feelings that every man feels when he goes home, you know, and he thinks about these things, you know, and he thinks about his life, he thinks about his woman, he thinks about his kid. And, I mean, and there's no room to be tough there.
Well, okay, so you were saying that, you know, in your CD, The Love Below, that means the person, like, the person beneath the tough veneer and the emotions beyond that tough exterior.
Right.
So let me play like the really big hit from this, which is Hey Ya, your song. And I mean, this song is like so much fun. And I guess fun is one of the things that would not be good if you're trying to have that really tough exterior. Yes?
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because in the Hey Ya video, I mean, I had a lot of fun doing it, and you can see a lot of smiles, you know. And I got a lot of feedback from just that alone, you know, a lot of DJs and a lot of people on the street. They were like, man, that's cool. Like, I ain't seen a rapper smile in a long time, you know. And I think smiling is powerful, you know. I mean, come on, God gave you teeth, he gave you lips, he gave you emotions. Come on, smile now. I mean, you ain't tough 24/7. You know, that's just not true. If you want to keep it real. Now, that's keeping it real.
Well, before we hear Hey Ya, would you just talk a little bit about putting this together, like writing the song? You play all of the instruments except bass on it, I think.
Right.
So can you talk about, like, conceiving the record and, you know, conceiving the song and then the music happening behind the song?
With Hey Ya, it was pretty much just me at home with my guitar, and I was playing these chords over and over and over again. I'm not a great guitar player, so these were some of the first chords that I ever learned. And, you know, during that time, you know, I was into a lot of garage, a lot of punk music, and I was just going for it. And so this was my interpretation of what I thought those sounds were. And the lyrics, usually, they start from me messing around on my guitar playing, and I'll just start to kind of baby talk lyrics, you know, and I usually record myself on a micro cassette recorder. And so, you know, I'll be yeah, 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 you know, and then I'll listen to it back and damn near translate what I'm saying, you know, like I almost have to decode my Yippity app, and that's what comes out, you know, my baby don't mess around because she loves me so, you know, and that's what came out, and it just starts to make sense after a while. And then I came back 3 years later working on the Speaker Box Love Below album and came back with the second verse. And then the, you know, Polaroid part, you know, that was kind of just a freestyle actually in the studio. And Beyonce's video was on the screen when I was doing the song. I forget which video it was, but I thought it was an amazing video, and she was showing plenty of attitude. And so that's how she crept her way into the song. You know, when it says, now Beyoncé's and Lucy Liu's, those were actually commercials or scenes that were on the TV when I was in the vocal booth. And they crept their way into the song.
So you're describing how you speak in almost, you know, like baby talk when you're first writing
right.
the melody for the song. Is the hey ya part of the original baby talk?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Yes. And that's probably why it's hey ya, because I really didn't have any words, so you just hey ya, you know.
Well, it works, doesn't it?
and then you fine tune it, and you know it's saying hey ya. It's kind of like really listening to another language, and then you listen back to it and say, oh, okay, now what is he saying? What is he saying? And then you make it out. You know, you've been a translator, and that's what happens. A lot of people get the song mistaken. They say, oh man, I love that hey now song. Like, well, it's hey ya.
Well, here it is. And this is Andre Benjamin from the Outkast album Speaker Box, The Love Below.
1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so, and this I know for sure.
Hey, yeah. We'll have more with Andre Benjamin after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with Andre Benjamin. As Andre 3000, he's half of the hip-hop duo Outkast.
Now, I read two things about your schooling. One was that you went to a performing arts high school, a magnet school, and the other is you went to a school for kids who were in trouble. So
right.
Is either or both of those true?
Yep, that is true. I went to Sutton Middle School, and that I tried out for the drama troupe. And we put on stage plays in middle school. And then I went to high school at Tri-Cities, which was a performing arts school. And that's where I met Big Boy. And they had the drama class. And, you know, they had all these extra classes that were fun, you know, fun classes. But when I got to high school, that's when I made the transition from living with my mom to living with my dad. And my dad, you know, he's never had me, you know, wholly. Where he's kind of like the only protector, the only person in the house. So I was kind of mischievous, and I pretend like I was going to school, but I actually wasn't going. And so I got kicked out of normal school, and they sent me to an alternative school, and that's where it's a school where people that are not doing the things they're supposed to be doing go. And so, yeah, both of those things are true. So it's kind of like I got influences from both sides. You know, you go to a performing arts school and you're doing this drama thing and you're doing music and you're doing talent shows. But then on the other end, you know, you're at the school where it's fights and, you know, it's pregnant girls and it's people carrying pistols and all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of like kind of crazy, but I mean, I guess that's all in what makes you, you know, your experiences make you that person.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about how you have these different personas. Did you have different personas for the performing arts school and a different one for the school with all, you know, like the tough kids carrying pistols and stuff? I mean, did you have to be a different person in each of those schools?
No, not at all. It was kind of crazy. It was like a culture clash because, I mean, I was living in, you know, I guess what you would call the lower housing part of Atlanta, you know, off of Bankhead. And my mom was smart enough to send me to a school in Buckhead, which is kind of like the best part of Atlanta, or like the rich part of town, where, you know, I was going to school with kind of like the mayor's kids and, you know, the commissioner's son and, you know, I guess the affluent of Atlanta. And it's funny because we all got along in a cool kind of way, and it was different experiences. So I'm coming home, you know, and I'm listening to Too Short and Kilo and N.W.A. and Eric B. and Rakim. Then I get to school, and I'm listening to NXS and Depeche Mode, you know, you know, that type of thing, you know, Duran, you know, Bad Brains and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, it's cool because I think any kid, I think you need to get out of where you are all the time. I think traveling and knowing different cultures or knowing, mm-hmm. you know, different parts of life, I think it helps you. I mean, because you become more. I mean, if you're in the hood 24/7, that's all you know. And I mean, people can't really blame you because that's all you know. So that's what you're going to come out like. But if you travel the world, or if you go to a different part of town, or like, okay, like I'm leaving the hood and I'm going to my school, and like one of my best friends was Andre, you know, his family, they're from France. So I'm spending the night over their house and, you know, speaking French, and they showing me all this type of different kind of food. And I had another homeboy named Ashok Shaw, you know, his family was East Indian. You know, so I'm going up to their house and I'm in their prayer circles and, you know, we're doing things I wouldn't normally do at home. So I'm getting to see other parts of life, you know, which is cool, you know.
You're a father. You have a son who's like 9 or something now. Is that about right?
Yep. He'll be 9 November 18th.
And his mother is Erica Badu, the singer. And you separated a while ago. And there's you've said that you gave up drugs and drinking and all that when, mm-hmm. when you were about to become a father and never looked back on that. You have a song, one of the really popular Outkast songs called Sorry Miss Jackson, mm-hmm. which I believe is dedicated to your son's maternal grandmother.
Right.
Can you talk about writing the song and why you want, like, what message you wanted to send her and why?
Well, let me just go back a little bit. I actually stopped drinking and smoking and all that type of stuff years before. I had a child, and years before I even met Erica. So it was kind of like a life decision because I was kind of just going too hard and too fast, you know, with the beginnings of Outkast. But the song Miss Jackson, like I've always heard songs about, you know, baby mama songs, but I thought it would be cool to do a song about how a baby's mama felt about you, because you always wonder, you know, does her mom like me, you know, or man, how does she feel, you know, that I've come into her daughter's life and then I'm not there anymore. And so, I mean, that was the approach of the song. And then I was in the studio working on the track with the, had a beat going, and I started playing these chords on the keyboard, and I started singing the lyrics that I had at home to this beat, and it worked perfectly. So it was kind of like melting the two together.
Did you actually apologize to your son's mother's mother for the pregnancy?
Well, no, I didn't. I really didn't. I mean, I don't know if it was one. I can't say if it was one deserved or not. But I mean, we make a joke about it now. You know, when I see a mom, you know, when the song was out, she would say, "You owe me publishing," you know, for this song, you know. But I mean, no, it wasn't like a formal, oh, I'm sorry, Miss Wright. Her name is Miss Wright, but I thought Miss Jackson, the syllable sounded better. And I thought people knew more Jacksons than Wrights. So.
Well, Andre Benjamin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Andre Benjamin, a.k.a. Andre 3000, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. He's half of the hip-hop duo Outkast, and his latest film, Idlewild, has just been released on DVD. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Yeah, this one right here goes out to all the babies, mamas, mamas. Mamas, mamas. Baby mamas, mamas. Yeah, go like this.
I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. I apologize a trillion times. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. I apologize a trillion times.
My baby is drama, mama. Don't like me. Doing things like having the boys come from her neighborhood to the studio trying to fight me. She need to get a piece of American pie and take her bite out. That's my house. I disconnect the cable and turn the lights out. And let her know her grandchild is a baby and not a paycheck. Private school, daycare, medical bills, I pay that. I love your mom and everything. See, I ain't the only one who lay down. She wanna rip you up and start a custody war. My lawyer, stay down. She never got a chance to hear my side of the story. We was divided. She had fish fries and cookouts for my child's birthday. I ain't invited, despite it. I show her the utmost respect when I fall through. All you do is defend that lady when I call you.
I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. I apologize a trillion times. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. And from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Iggy Pop remembers his days as a high school misfit with a crew cut. We'll also talk about playing hard, living harder, and getting older. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We lost the godfather of soul this week, but we still have the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop. He's still in the game. He has a new CD called The Weirdness, scheduled to come out in March. But his influence on punk music has continued unabated for more than 35 years. Many of the punk bands of the 70s picked up on what Iggy Pop and his band The Stooges were doing in 1969. In 1977, music critic John Rockwell wrote, "Rock and roll is full of wild men toying with the limits of the possible or the permissible. In many ways, the farthest out of them all was Iggy Pop," unquote. As for Iggy Pop's music, in 1970, music critic Robert Christgau wrote, "I regret all the times I've ever used words like power and energy to describe rock and roll, because this is what such rhetoric should have been saved for." T. Terry Gross spoke with Iggy Pop in 2005 when he released a 2-CD anthology of his music. It features his recordings with the Stooges, with whom he recently reunited, and also his solo work. It includes this now-famous song from the Stooges' first 1969 album, I Wanna Be Your Dog.
Iggy Pop, welcome to Fresh Air. Are those sleigh bells on the record?
Those are sleigh bells, the jazz instrument. You know, I was a drummer and percussionist before I was a vocalist. So, and I always liked jazz music, and so I was keen to use something to give the song a certain sense of space. Huh. And yeah, the sleigh bells sound. You know, they resound in a certain way, baby.
Now, you are now considered basically the godfather of punk. Did you think of yourself as being ahead of your time or just as like being different when you started to perform with the Stooges?
You better be different if you want to make any sort of lasting impression, I think. So there was, you know, there was some conscious effort to stand out. I didn't think there was a big future in sort of wearing a bowl haircut and a little polyester shirt and, imitating the Yardbirds or something. So we were trying to do something fresh. And then the timeliness issue, that's tricky. And I still don't know what the real meaning of that phrase, it's ahead of your time, is, you know.
Well, in this case, sure. I mean, the sound that you were creating was inspired
right.
A lot of other bands.
I would have to say the rest of the world was behind its effing time, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. We were, as far as I was concerned, where things should be for us anyway, given what talent we had to make the sounds. These were the sounds that were suggested to me by the architecture of the time, the ideas of the time, the social quakes of that time, things like that, and the musical history, the automotive design, all that suggested this music, and also a lot of this was the next logical step of the best current music being done at that time, as far as I was concerned.
Well, how did the ideas of the time shape the music in the sense that, you know, we're talking 1969, your first album, and, you know, for a lot of people, this is the era of, say, like, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, or the Grateful Dead, or the Jefferson Airplane, right?
That was just all the phony. That shit was all phony as a $3 bill, really. And all those people were they were talking one thing and living another. You know, these you must have noticed they all got fat really quickly physically, and there's a reason for that. It was a visual sign of their incredible corruption. You know, and I mean in the case of the Airplane, they went all the way from White Rabbit to We Built This City on Rock and Roll. It's just this crappy song, you know. But,
Iggy Pop is never going to get fat. No one's going to accuse you of being fat.
Well, you know, but there was, there was all that going on, and basically I think Meet the New Boss, same as the old boss in Won't Get Fooled Again by Pete Townsend, sums it up in a certain way. But there was a new bunch that was going to organize the disaffected youth and be a new group of leaders for us. And we came along, my band and I came along at just a couple years behind these people and just thought, gee, do they suck? to put it in an inarticulate, inchoate way, but to get more articulate about it, the musical goods were swinging less and less. And there was more and more artifice built without a good foundation, which is why it didn't really make you feel very good. It just sounded really impressive, and then the promises made weren't really going to be kept at any power level in the society. If I turned on the radio, if I turned on AM radio, I had to wait for 39 Leslie Gore songs to hear one good Beatles song, right? I turned on the FM radio, I had to hear some guy who's, you know, acting really, you know, like really like he was a really cool guy, and we're going to play Mr. Fantasy again by Traffic, you know. Dig the flute on this, you know. And it was just so awful and boring, and, you know, you had this crappy, and then everybody jumped on the bandwagon. So you had this pathetic song by a group called the Chambers Brothers, who were, you know, a likable black singing group who decided, we got to get in on this psychedelic thing. So they had a song called The Time, and it was, you know, my mind has been psychedelicized. And it's just a lot of, you know, crap. And then professional songwriters, of course, who not to be left behind in the Brill Building, you know, the same guys who used to write, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to. Then they had to get in on the act, and they're writing songs like My Green Tambourine, which you can play on the thing if you want, on this show if you want to illustrate my point, you know.
Iggy Pop speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Iggy Pop, the godfather of punk.
One of the things you've done on stage is dive into the audience. Which I think a lot of other people copied over the years.
Yeah, the first time I did that, it was just, I was opening for the Mothers of Invention. It was the second show we'd ever played. I'd played with the Stooges. It was the first one I did as a front vocalist. I had set down the guitar and I was, you know, just front the band, and I was terrified, and I was looking for a way to get a certain kind of attention and make something happen. There was a gap between myself and the audience, and physical gap. It was too wide, and I wanted it to close. And there were only a couple of girls came and got very near the stage, but that was it. No other takers. So I thought, well, it'd be cool if I fell on them. And I did what little kids do. I don't know if you got kids, but they go through a phase, I think they're about 3 or 4, maybe 5 or 6, where they'll stand very rigid and sort of mime falling on the floor,
mm-hmm.
falling on their face. I did that. And they didn't catch me. So I had chipped a tooth pretty badly on that gig. But that began some of my fascination with crossing the proscenium. It wasn't long after that I had a pair of jeans that I really, really liked. And I didn't want to stop wearing them at gigs, and they started getting rips and slits and holes. And nobody else was doing that either. Nobody even walked on the street with holes in their pants. And now I see every little hairdresser in L.A. walking around with slit up pants, and Michael Jackson, and it's incredible. I got that basically that fashion from it was a reverse of what R&B singers used to do. P.J. Proby was famous for this. They would wear pants that were very, very thin and lightly basted instead of well sewn, and they go out on stage, and when they do an acrobatic split or something, the pants would rip open, and it was supposed to be a sexually charged event in the show. So I just thought, well, why not just come out with them already ripped? let's just drop the ceremony here, you know.
Well, you hardly
came
out
with a ripped pants, you know.
You've come out with hardly any clothes to begin with. I mean, you rarely wear anything on your chest. You're usually like bare chested.
They all say something. Everything you wear says something. And I just felt that what everything was saying was getting in the way. If you wear a T-shirt that says, free Katie Holmes, you're saying something. You know? You wear a blue Oxford shirt, you're saying something.
But, of course, if you're bare-chested, you're saying something, too. You can't get away from it.
It can mean a lot of things. It can mean a lot of things. It's a little more basic. I got a lot of ideas for the Stooges in the undergrad library of the University of Michigan. I still had my library card. I was a college dropout, and I thought, well, this is going to take some thought, there are a lot of good books in here. I used to go there and read a lot of Social Anth, which gave me a lot of ideas about behavior, tribal behavior, and its possible application to rock shows. But I was also just looking at a book of Egyptian antiquity one day, and all the pharaohs never wear shirts. And I just kept looking, and I thought, gee, there's something about that. There's something expressive. Now, it's not going to work, if you're a big fat guy with a hairy chest, then that's different. But if you have I was lucky enough. I had a sort of a basically normal, I thought, hey, I can do Pharaoh. Yeah,
You have a very interesting body. I mean, like your arms, at least nowadays, it looks like you've been working out. Your arms look pretty pumped up, but your chest is like so thin and always has been. And so you see like every rib and sometimes even like blood vessels you can see.
Yeah, funny boy.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like it's an interesting and very skinny body.
I don't pump, by the way.
You don't?
No, just for the record, I do something. I like to go swimming a lot, uh-huh. And I have a lot of sex, and I do something related to Tai Chi called Qigong.
Why don't we hear another track from the anthology? And I thought we could play something from Raw Power. And there's two things I can't make up my mind between these two, so I'm going to let you decide. We can either hear Give Me Danger or Raw Power. What do you think?
I would take Give Me Danger.
Okay. And why are you choosing it?
It's a little more musically complex.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about writing
just
it?
Just as a muso, I just like that one a little better. The conceit in the title was just taken from the Stones had a song called Gimme Shelter, and the theme of the song being, there are all sorts of turbulent and dangerous things going on, and maybe some existential loneliness and angst of the modern hero, that sort of thing. And I was looking at the life that myself and my band at that time were barely leading. And I thought, basically, we're looking for trouble and we've got it. And I understood that, but I thought I could forestall the ticking of the clock long enough to make a nice work of art. So basically, this song fit into that. That was the general theme of that album, was being Raw Power, was being in the service of some very basic and powerful forces to your eventual detriment, and you know, it's leading in the kind of a very destructive direction eventually. And then this particular one is about basically it's saying in a very elaborate way, I go for really bad chicks. that's the basic thing of the song. You know? Hey, if you're a really bad chick, you know, that's you're probably my type, baby. That's the deal.
So when you say "and I'll feel your disease," are you referring to VD?
Well, no, not necessarily. Okay. Just whatever
you got.
Whatever's wrong. Whatever's okay. Wrong. Yeah.
You're in danger, little stranger, and I'll feel you are feeling. Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll feel your disease. There's nothing in my dreams, just some ugly memories. Kiss me like the ocean breeze. Hey!
You were saying before we heard that you and your band at the time were looking for trouble and finding it. You talked about being under the sway of powerful forces. Were you talking at all there about drugs?
Well, yeah, the drugs came into it as, but they're really, those are enablers of deeper things, usually. So basically, we were a bunch of guys who, somewhere along the line, in one way or another, each of us, what we had in common was each of us had put a foot out of line and we weren't going along with the quote-unquote the program. But I thought what it really did, the really pronounced effect it had on me, all of them had in common, was to shut out all sorts of things. And that kind of was really helpful at certain times when you're trying to make something creative. There are all sorts of voices within and without you that are going to say, no, it's not worth doing. No, it will never get finished correctly. No, it's no good. No, nobody will like it. No, it's not worth thinking about. No, it would be more fun or more profitable to go do X, Y, and Z instead of sticking on plan A, that sort of thing. Drugs were pretty good for shutting out a lot of the naysay in existence, at least for me, for a while. And then basically my experience was that little by little they rocked and socked my nervous system too much to be worth the trouble. And then finally, and very quickly after that, I don't know, as a tide recedes late in the day, all the possible positives just seem to disappear and you're just left with the hideous negatives.
Right.
That's kind of how it went for me.
And you did the
whole thing. You're sort of like, I could compare it, if I could compare my body to a neighborhood, a really nice neighborhood that everybody suddenly becomes popular and quickly becomes overdeveloped. That's sort of like, basically, the drugs begin to build condos all over your body until you don't want to live there anymore. Kind of like that, you know?
Iggy Pop, speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Iggy Pop, the godfather of punk.
Do you think of Iggy Pop as being like a stage persona, and are you still Jim Osterberg offstage?
Well, that used to be the case, but not anymore, is I've been Iggy Pop longer than I was just Jim Osterberg.
Mm-hmm.
So things have changed. It's been, I started being me when I was, I don't know how many years old, 21, something like that. And that was 37 years ago. So I was only without me for about 20 years.
Was that how you felt when you created, like, Iggy Pop, that you had figured out who you really were, that was who you really
no,
were?
No, I was just like I gained the services of an extra person, actually. You know, it's, as Iggy Pop, there are all sorts of things I can do and receive and be that were not happening for Jim Osterberg. And then I have a great deal of pleasure being Jim Osterberg, and I have just a really lovely private existence that way. And Iggy does a lot for me.
What does Iggy do for you?
Well, he pays, for one thing. And very well, I might add. He saves me all sorts of social necessities, you know, because he's known. He gets me a good table.
In the 70s and in the 80s, did you expect that you were going to die young?
No. No. I never even, I don't know about you, but you don't think about those sort of thing until you hit 50-something, you know, and then little voice starts saying, hey, guess what? Guess what? You know what the next phase is, don't you? That's right. Ciao, bunny bunny. What are you going to do with the time anyway? Sort of thing.
Well, if you're hearing that voice, is that changing anything for you?
Yeah, you think about all sorts of things. Probably it makes you a little more mellow about some of the little everyday human encounters. A little more, not much. And then otherwise probably makes a little more careful. And other than that, it's sort of like if I looked at the arc of my life emotionally, I'd say that the last part's starting to resemble the first part. In that the first 7 years, I feel that I'm in the seventh 7 year cycle of my profession. I am professionally in that. I thought about this the other day. I started in the early mid 60s. I got my union card, and pretty much my life's gone in 7 year cycles, and this is the seventh now. I'm about a year into it, and this is the last one. When I finish this one, I'll be 65, and that's that's about as old as you can get, and not be forced to kind of shift your, you have to shift your professional outlook, I think, to second base at that point. But right now, I'm still a loaded gun, and on the first seven and the last seven, each seem to be based on a lot of thought about, okay, what do I really want to do here, and how can I do it to the best of my ability, and then of course, how can I fend off anybody who isn't going along with that,
now,
which involves just all sorts of buddies.
Now that you have this,
then of course you enjoy support. I get a lot more support now than I did during the first 7 years, mm-hmm. which is great because when you're an old git, you need it. So I've got money now that I need money. You know, I'll have a little bit of, you know, a little bit of attention. I need it. You know, because it's harder to break through the paper mache at this point.
Terry Gross spoke with Iggy Pop last year. He's working on a new CD, which is expected out in March. Fresh Air was produced and edited this year by Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Sharrock, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar, with Sue Spolin, Joan Tui-Westman, Mike and Scott, and Lauren Krenzel. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our engineers are Julian Hirschfeld, Audrey Bentham, and Joyce Lieberman. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming. For my fellow guest host Dave Davies, and for Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli. We'll go out with Jimi Hendrix playing this New Year's Eve classic at the Fillmore East in 1969. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a very happy New Year.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting The Good German, a new film by Steven Soderbergh, starring George Clooney, Cate Blanchett, and Tobey Maguire, now playing. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. And from Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Leonard Cohen chooses his words carefully. On the New Year's Day edition of Fresh Air, the poet and singer joins us to talk about his career and his music. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
If you want a lover, I'll do anything you want.